Hello, everybody. I'm going to get started. I'm Brad. I'll be chairing for this afternoon. Glad that you're all here. You're here for the Face of God, the Filter of Mormon Iconography. Andy and Tracy. I'll introduce them both in a moment. This will be an hour-long session. Of course, remind you to please silence your phones. We'll go till about 4:15. We'll have Andy go and then Tracy. I'm privileged to be able to chair this one because Andy's a friend of mine. So it's nice for me to introduce him. I won't add too much that's not on the biography, but Andy's a native of Pampa, Texas. In 1999, he moved to Utah to begin his freshman year at BYU. His passion and gifts earned him a scholarship in vocal performance. He explored the opera. Go to his website, he's got some good singing in the background. And he performed many roles, most memorably Alma in the international broadcast debut of Abinadi, a musical drama adapted from the Book of Mormon, Another Testament of Jesus Christ. It continues to air on KBYU-TV. In 2010, he appeared in a series of off-Broadway productions in New York City. In 2008, he graduated summa cum laude from the University of Utah, and the College of Humanities honored him with the Award for Excellence in Applied Linguistics. He served as an educator and curriculum developer in both public and private schools from around the corner to Times Square and Catalonia, Spain. He traveled overseas as translator, cultural attaché, and full-time volunteer missionary. He and his colleagues were invited to be presenters at the 2009 International TESOL Conference. Some of you may have noticed that he was doing his book signing as well. He's an author. Since 2002, he's worked as a professional skier, and he's learned from thousands of hours training wee babies and 40-year veteran instructors alike. His skis have taken him from Park City, Utah, to New Zealand and beyond. After he's done, we'll hear from the respondent Tracy McKay, who has a background in the fine arts, including studying painting at CalArts in Southern California, and design at the Art Institute of Seattle. She has shown solo work in galleries and museums in California and Washington, and currently helps support her way towards her MS with her painting and writing. Tracy is a divorced mother of three and an adult convert to the church, and she's a BCC by Common Concurrence Kent blogger. Also blogs at dandelionmama.wordpress and mormonmommywars.com. Without further ado, I'll turn the time over to them.
Thank you. Thank you for coming and joining us today. I might just flip the switch here just so we can see what's going on in front. A little bit. Is it too many lights? Do you want one in back? Nobody?
That's good.
All right, that's good. All right, I prepared a few slides here today, but more than anything, I need your help. Now, the Face of God, the Filter of Mormon Iconography. Why? Well, I can't possibly put up every icon that we could examine today or think of, or your favorites, or your favorites, or my favorites. So, I'm going to rely on your help today to access all of those, all of the above. I couldn't collect every example. How are we going to do that? First of all, first things first. We just come back from lunch, or maybe a million presentations today. Who knows what our bodies feel like? With me for just a second. Stand up if you'd like to stand up, if you'd like to stay seated. Sit as tall and as flexible as you can. Ah, let your shoulders melt away from your ears, okay? And you can keep your eyes closed or open, whatever is most comfortable for you. Who remembers now when Adam became a living soul? Anyone? When did Adam become a living soul on the footstool of God?
With breath.
With the breath of life. And God breathed the breath of life into Adam, and he became a living soul. This is how we're going to connect with ourselves today. Our life. The life that the Creator's given us. Okay? Range of breath now. All the very top of the lungs and the very bottom. Those areas we don't usually use and probably haven't a lot today. Now you're going to make noise, okay? Listen to me here. A couple deep breaths. Join. All the way in and all the way out. Don't be afraid to make noise with it. It's like the living ocean as the waves come in. A
and then as the waves go out. Instant connection to your life and to your Creator, just through your breath. Okay? And now, connected to all of us. We all have that same breath. Go ahead and sit if you'd like, all right?
That'll be very important today in clearing our mind and focusing on some of these images. So, first things first, a warm up to get what I call our personal icon catalog, all right? So it's just a name I gave it. That's all the images floating around in your head. Wow, that's a lot, okay? Since you were born and all of your upbringing in the church or in a different church or in many churches, all of these images and icons, all right? I'm going to call them today PIC, personal icon catalog, PIC. Simple enough, okay? So when you see this word flash on screen, PIC, it'll instantly trigger in your mind. Okay, maybe eyes closed or open, however, and you're going to fish for this image, whatever your image is. Let's do an example. Here it is, okay? Picture this, all right? Nephi. Oh, all right. Maybe you see, as we came in, there were three portraits. If you didn't see, I'll put them up on screen. No worries. Take just a moment and consider Nephi now. And why? Why Nephi? Take a few breaths into it. Okay, you got him? Why? Is it the way he looks? Is it maybe his character? Is it something he said? Maybe some of his writings or a particular story? How do you picture Nephi from the Book of Mormon? This will be 1st Nephi, the Nephi that wrote 1st and 2nd Nephi. Okay, let's put these onto the screen now. Here's A, one choice, all right? And I'll tell you, think of who you chose as Nephi. And I'm gonna tell you about a little study I did, just a little test. I took these portraits around, and I've been doing that today as well. But my study, I included 100 people at random in the area here in Salt Lake Valley. And I asked them the same question. Now, they had to understand immediately who Nephi was, and then they'd see these pictures. A, we actually only had 5%, excuse me, of that 100 choose A. All right? And that's rounding up to the nearest 5%. B, we only had about almost 10% choose B. All right. Now, if you're joining us on the tape, then I'm sorry that you can't see these. I'll post them on the website. But B, only 10%. And the remaining 85% chose C. Ah. It's the headband, we say. A couple of them have headbands. One has, you know, one holding a little bit of a cloth on his head, too. All right. Here they are again, side by side. A, B, and C. Who did you choose? You don't have to answer. But I'll tell you something revealing about the models here, okay? A is a model. I sketched these. There's the surprise. All of them. My interpretation of what Nephi might have been like. A is from a Missoniad. Missoni is an Italian high fashion company, okay? So he came from a current Missoniad. And I just added the towel on the head here and a little bit of the headband. Now, B is a Vietnam vet that passed away a few years ago. Actual person. I added the beard to him, of course, but he's a little bit older. And C is from an Armani advertisement. If you go on the Armani catalog online right now, this man's face, minus the glasses and headband, you might see. Okay. Now, why did I do this? C is the one, the Armani ad is the one that 85% of us chose. Why? Let's think about it, okay? Let's switch gears a little bit, okay? Pick, here we go again, another one. Picture this, all right? Any media icon, and why? Same thing again, but any media icon that comes to your mind, or a number of them, probably the first one that comes, it's the best choice. And why? Is it the way this person looks? Is it the way this person talks? Is it what this person talks about, maybe? Or the work that this person engages in. What makes this person the icon that comes to your mind? All right? Don't forget this person. All right. Now, I'm going to describe three friends of mine. All right? These are my three friends. As I describe them now to you, you might come to realize that they're not just my three friends, but they're our three friends and family friends. Okay? One of them is a middle-aged woman in her 50s, raised six beautiful children. She finds it difficult to stand for long periods of time. Her body's giving out. She has to shop for her clothes from just a couple of online retailers that carry her size. And she doesn't understand what she needs to do to regain the use of her body. Another one of my friends, he, for many of the same reasons, has to purchase his clothes at specialty stores. Hard to find. He doesn't like to travel or go out much because people usually ask him to buy a second seat on transportation. And he always has to find a seatbelt extension. And my third friend is a very young 10-year-old with much the same problems. Doesn't find too many friends at school and struggles also with his self-image. Now, how many like our three friends have you seen in the media in the last month, let's say? Just think to yourself. How many fitting their description? Maybe one or two. Anyone? No? I need your help here. This is a real question. No? Yeah?
You see them, but they're faceless.
That you see them, but they're faceless. Okay.
Only their, yeah.
Sometimes. Okay. Anybody remember the actor John Candy?
Yes.
Okay, well, there's one. He is a very large man as well, but very few, right? And under certain conditions, okay? So, let's find out. A couple of wee studies. Gillen and Barr, 1994, Journal of Adolescent Health. Their study of Mass Media magazine turns out they find 10.5 times more weight loss articles or ads in women's issues than in men's issues. Is there a message here? Maybe. Let's look at another study. Myers et al., 1992, Journal of Communication. Their study included 4,294 network television commercials. They find that one in 3.8 commercials informs of what is or is not attractive. That's more than 5,260 attractiveness messages, they call them, every year, around 15 a day. Quite a lot of opinions of what's attractive or not coming at us. Okay, so true or false? This is what interests me. Not so much the studies and what they say they can prove or disprove. Or what interests me is what you believe in this moment. All right? So, true or false? Do you believe this statement? Current media strategies and advertising campaigns build strong self-esteem and broaden awareness of beauty. Now, keep in mind, a lot of us have blamed media for teenage girls' eating disorders and for poor self-image and other things. But it interests me only what you believe in this moment. So, one more. Picture this. Jesus Christ. Been picturing all kinds of things, but this one will be fun to breathe into. Picture your favorite icon of Christ. How you see Christ. Find it. Now, imagine or picture all of those images you've seen of Christ with those gathered around him. Children, adults, all of them. It could be when he visited the Americas. Could be maybe at his second coming. And now picture, if you've seen anyone like our three friends and family painted in the company of Christ. Have you seen anyone weighing over 350 pounds?
No.
Painted in the company of Christ. So, we we point fingers at the media for their message, their attractiveness messages in the media. But they don't carry a spiritual weight with them as much as perhaps our religious art. Do we have then attractiveness messages in our art? Okay. Don't have to answer. All right, here we go. Going on. The mighty icon. Honestly, we don't know what Nephi looks like, right? So it doesn't matter. But the point is, he could be any one of those. He could actually look just like you and me, and not like the person on the cover of Armani Vogue. All right, the mighty icon. Let's first define icon before we go too far into this. New Oxford American Dictionary. We'll just use a simple, we'll get on the same page and see what icon is. New Oxford American Dictionary says the use or study of images or symbols in visual arts. Okay? They also say the illustration of a subject by drawings or figures. Do you agree? Disagree? Okay. Well, how about we use this maybe for right now? I like the Greek. I propose we just use the simplicity of the Greek translation. Icon, likeness, and graphia, writing. So likeness writing. All right? Sticking just with that simple idea. Let's just look at a few icons, okay? See if these are icons. This is a Jesus Christ detail from the Diocese Mosaic in Hagia Sophia, Istanbul. Is that how you picture Christ? It's not exactly like mine, but anyway, maybe it's closer to yours. Who knows? Oh, here's one from the Sistine Chapel. One of the scenes has a few names. Original. Well, I won't say it yet because we'll revisit this one. I wanna revisit this one by Michelangelo Buonarroti. Lovely image. Here's one. Here is a symbol. Here is an icon that is missing, or at least I find in my experience, missing from the Mormon experience. Now, I've come to relate to this symbol. It's the cross, those of you on the tape. It's the cross, the crucifix. I've come to see this as a bit of a problem, I think. Because, to me, this would be like wearing the electric chair around your neck, right? As far as symbols goes, before Christ, hanging one of these around your neck would be like the electric chair or firing squad around your neck. Seems pretty weird, doesn't it? That somebody would now, if the Romans could see us hanging, you know, torture symbols, and what was once the most infamous symbol of human conquest and crushing of other people, just simple two intersecting lines, doesn't mean the same thing to humanity at large today. We see these in every country, people wearing crucifixes. To me, it represents the power of Jesus Christ that I believe in, is someone to take such a horrible, even the worst symbol possible at the time, and re-gift it to humanity in a timeless way, that shows his power of transformation and of change. And to me, when that symbol's gone, that simple two lines, it didn't change, did it? Still two little lines. But its meaning is so different for us. Anyway, going on. What about these? Are these icons? Symbols? Illustrations? Yeah, I see some nods. Good. The English alphabet. Good. If those are icons, the Holy Scriptures, I hope those are icons. You find those to be icons? Yes, no? We agree? Yeah, I see some nods. Good, I agree. So, here's what we're going to do now. Let's compare our likenesses to our writings. Let's compare the visual icons to some of the textual icons and see if they match up. Okay, just a little wee exercise. Here we go again. I told you we'd come back to it. This is Michelangelo's, one of his pieces on the Sistine Chapel. Somebody, I need somebody to tell me what is going on in this painting, especially for the people on the tape. Anyone? Thank you. What's your name?
Jennifer,
thank you. What is this a painting of? What is this?
In the first picture, it shows Satan as the snake tempting Adam and Eve and getting them to take the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the other side of the image is an angel kicking them out of the garden afterwards.
Hear, hear. I see that. What's this story about then? Well, how would you, if you were to give it a title, what might you entitle it?
The Fall.
The Fall. Good. Okay. You agree?
Huh? Estrangement.
Estrangement. Another one. Very good. Anyone else? You know, on the Vatican website, they entitle it a couple of things. Original Sin or Adam and Eve's Expulsion from the Garden. Okay? Very good. Now, why were they cast out of the garden here? Why is it called Original Sin? Do you agree with that? Show of hands. Is this a painting about sin? No? Yes, no? Maybe? You see how it is? Maybe? Okay. Let's just do a little experiment here together then. Quantitative analysis, all right? We're going to count. Can't get simpler than that here. One scripture. I don't know what it is. Right there. I don't know if it's Sesame Street's on, but we're going to count. All right. Sin and transgression. Every time we see that word, we're going to circle it in green. And every time we see the words shame or fear, we'll circle it in red. How's that? We can choose any words we want, but let's choose these for right now. I don't particularly find the name Original Sin a good name for that, you know, like is on the website, the Vatican website. I don't think the story's really about sin, but we'll find out. Here we go. I'm going to back up. Genesis 3 is entract serpent, okay? You said snake. We might just stick with the word serpent, and I'll show you why here. But going back, in any story, the background is one of the most important places. That's, if you don't know what the setting is, how can you start? Once upon a time, right? So here's our once upon a time. We find it in the last verse of Genesis 2:25. And they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. Both naked, and were not ashamed. Well, red, because shame, there's the word. You see it in there? So we got to circle it in red. But both naked. Now, who would be ashamed right now if you were naked? Imagine that. Picture this. All your clothes just gone. Anybody?
In this room.
Oh, man, yes, right now. Would you try and hide or cover up or something? Here, the references page or something? I would, too. There's a lot of shame that we might feel there. But they were naked and not ashamed. Interesting. Now, the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, why serpent? I'm going to underline this right now. Because speaking of icons, we said the devil is a snake, right? Who else in the scriptures or where else does a serpent appear? Anyone? Any thoughts?
When the Israelites are leaving Egypt and they all get sick, I can't remember exactly why, it's one of those random stories.
Fiery serpents came to bite him.
Fiery serpents, and then also when Moses has the thing, he raises a serpent on a stick and says, look at this and you'll get healed. And some of them looked and were healed, other ones didn't bother and they died.
Thank you. Moses raises a serpent on a staff to symbolize Jesus Christ. What? There's a serpent right here, but the serpent is also used to symbolize Christ. Wait a minute, I'm confused now. Where else? The great white bearded God in Native American history is depicted as what? A winged serpent. Okay, we won't go too much more into that, but you see, serpent, wait a minute. So what is this serpent? Maybe there's more there. Anyway, oh, I went too far ahead there. Now, the serpent was more subtle and says to Eve, hath God not said, ye shall not eat of, can't you eat of all the trees of the garden? And the woman said unto the serpent, yep. We can do that. We need of all of them. But the fruit of the tree, which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. She knows what the conditions are. She didn't just get, Dad said I can't. I have no clue why. No, she knows. I can, but if I do, I'll die. All right. And the serpent said unto the woman, you shall not die. You're not going to die. For God doth know in that day that ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened. I find redundancy in the scriptures is a very important thing, especially when there aren't very many words describing a story. So let's keep looking. When in the scriptures is eyes being opened also described? And is it a bad thing or a good thing? Let's think some more. Here we go. Oh, there it is again. And ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. And when the woman saw this, that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit and did eat and gave also unto her husband with her. And he did eat. And the eyes of them both were opened. So there it is again. So is the serpent lying then? Or telling the truth? A lot of truth, right? Said your eyes were going to be open. Bingo, their eyes were open. Wow. So now we see how this particular serpent's working. Ah, a lot of truth, but a little sneakiness in there. And they knew that they were naked and sewed fig leaves and made themselves aprons. And they heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God. Who has heard in Christianity that sin separates you from God? I have. I served a mission in Italy. I hear it a lot, too, everywhere. But it's interesting that I don't find the Lord to be ignorant. He knew what had happened. Why is he walking in the garden in the cool of the day calling for Adam? When he knows what he's done. He's looking for Adam. And he hides himself. And the Lord God said unto Adam, and said unto him, where art thou? And he said, I heard thy voice in the garden, and I was afraid. Oop, fear, there we go, afraid. Because I was naked. Ah, and I hid myself. Now, I love paradox, mirror images. Here we have naked, not ashamed, and then we have this hiding oneself, afraid, and naked. You see that? You see this backwards and forwards just after they took the fruit. All right, going on, and they hide themselves. Again, all this redundancy, hiding themselves, eyes opened, ashamed, naked, naked. Whew. All right, let's go on. This part I really love. It shows how the Lord responds. Adam says, I hid myself, I was naked, I was afraid. Does he go, aha! I know what you've done. No, he doesn't. He says, wait, who told you you were naked? I think he knows the answer. But he still asks Adam, says, who said you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree? Which one? The one I said not to, you know? That one. And now we see man's nature. Ooh! No, it wasn't his woman. Huh? And what does the Lord say? He says to the woman, this is pretty serious accusations here. What he's saying, is this right? What is this you've done? Is this the thing? And she says, oh, not me, the serpent. So you see God very lovingly and patiently, never accusing, never pointing a finger of judgment, only asking questions. And we see mankind saying, oh, not me, oh, passing blame, oh, not me, it was him, it was her, oh, I didn't do it. All right, interesting. So two, let's see, let's count them up. I didn't see any green, but I saw two under shame and fear. To me, just doing a quantitative analysis, the story, to me, it's not about sin as much as it is about shame and fear and hiding ourselves from the Lord. So how well do then our visual icons and our textual icons truly line up? Has anyone learned anything from a picture that they haven't from the storybook? I have. I love artist interpretations. Sometimes it's like, I never thought of that. Oh, you're right. That person might have been touched in a way that I wasn't. Now, who's learned from textual accounts then what they can't from the pictures? I have too. All right. So, here we go. Let's continue with this theme. If we wanted to learn... How are we doing on time, man? We're good? Good? All right.
You're fine.
Good. If we wanted to study Michelangelo's work, okay, like the painting we saw, how beneficial would it be to immerse ourselves in Monet's artwork, his creations? Does that make sense? I wouldn't do it personally. Maybe we could learn something, but mostly I believe to study Michelangelo, we'd have to study Michelangelo's work and his creations, right? That's where we'd learn the most about maybe him. Very similarly, if we wanted to learn most about the Creator, would we study then our artwork depicting the Creator? Or would we study perhaps the portraits and the artwork he has left us. His, like I say here, the creator's masterpiece theater. There we go. Just a couple of examples, okay? Too many to consider, but we're just going to look at a few, all right? I love it. As a matter of fact, Bhima Salam, my friend here, this is a flower from her garden. I took this picture. It's one of my favorites, oriental poppies. Lovely, stunning flowers, okay? Papaver orientale. Here's another one, Isophysis tasmanica. This is a bloom I've never seen, but it is absolutely gorgeous. By the way, for reference, all of my pictures come from Wikimedia Commons, so you can access them as well, too, okay? Lovely flower! Lovely flower. I'm taken with flowers, if you can't tell. But Rieger, Michaelis, and Green, 1991, The Glossary of Genetics, teach us that over 85% of flowering plants are hermaphroditic. Maybe not too much of a surprise, maybe for some of you. But there are hermaphroditic variations in the remaining 15%. So both male and female, or in that remaining 15%, they might start male and end up female and then go back or not, or start female, develop male at some point. Anyway, this is just flowering plants, a small group of creations, right? Animals. Oh, some interesting things about some of these animals. These are clownfish, right? Did anyone see what was the famous Nemo? Yes, Finding Pixar. Lovely. This looks like Nemo and his dad, right? Kind of to me. Anyway, clownfish. I like clownfish. Did you know that all clownfish start life as males? Every one of them. And they finish as females. It's usually that the female is the one that's the biggest, and then when she moves on or passes away, the largest male then takes over and becomes the female. And they all get to do that at some point, or unless something happens, naturally, of course. Also of interest, wrasses, these are cool. They kind of do the opposite. They kind of go mostly female to male, but the fascinating thing about them is that they have multiple types of males. Some that socialize and behave more like women, yet use the reproductive means in their groups, and others that are terminal males, that are more dominant males, that behave more like males than females. So it's very interesting what these animals do. Moving on, oh, here's another wrasse. Look at the colors on these. Isn't that remarkable? Isn't that stunning? People spend thousands of dollars to get their whole bodies tattooed like that. Anyway, Irish goat. Here, why did I do that? A lot of gender research in mammals is done on goats and pigs as well, because it's quite an interesting subject. Anyway, this is one I like here. Now, this isn't one of the breeds I'm going to describe, but the whiptail lizards. Oh, a serpent. Here it is. Whiptails even include some species all female. All female species. And what happens is that they even engage in pseudo-copulation between females just to increase fertility, yet they still produce their own eggs. The one on top or on bottom produces the bigger or smaller eggs, and then they switch next season so that the other one gets to lay the bigger eggs and have a better chance at offspring. Now, they still, even with this ability that they have, manage to adapt and evolve, which has scientists completely baffled. But that's just a serpent. Let's go on here. Ah. Anyone recognize this picture? No? Santi Sundarajan, I'm not sure how to say the name. If you know, please correct me. But Santi is my age, actually, born in 81, and did not start eating proper meals until 2004. And then in 2006, won this medal you see here in the Asian Games, the 2006 Asian, a runner. What happened was that some of the opponents obviously demanded drug tests and gender tests. And Santi got the test results back for the first time in her life that even though she's fully female externally, she has she's totally different on the inside. Anyway, she had her medal stripped from her. She faced intense ridicule and then had to be on suicide watch for a while. Now she is, I think, teaching runners in India, last I heard. Here's another picture of another runner. 2009, even more recently, Caster Semenya, South African. Now, her test results, very similar. She broke the 800-meter world record at 18 years old. Been running her whole life. And for the first time in her life, somebody says, wait a minute, let's check you out. Let's see if you're really a woman. Come to find out, very similar story. But her test results were leaked and then retracted, so I won't tell you what she says. It's her privacy, and her official results were never released. I have a magazine article at home that's a little different. But the point is, what's on the outside is not always what's on the inside. And you don't always know it if you don't start eating proper meals until 2004. It's not like, you know, how many ladies have checked themselves out. You don't. All right, Blacklist and these others here, et al., 2000. How sexually dimorphic are we? Review and synthesis. Study of medical literature from 1955 to 1998 for the frequency of sexual variations. One in 1,666 births is neither XX nor XY. Wow, I didn't know that. One of 100 births is a body different than standard male or female. One in 100 is different than male or female. One in 2 of 1,000 people undergo corrective genital surgery. Again, these numbers, maybe you've heard them, maybe you haven't. I'm going to go on to a little bit different subject. Brad, maybe you've heard of this. Brad's also expert in biology and law as well. But this is me. I'm an artist and an actor. But this is quite a fascinating subject to me. Y chromosome degeneration. Whew! We won't get too technical. We'll just look at a couple of things. From Mariah Sedol, 2010. The human Y is a genetically degenerate chromosome which has lost about 97% of the genes originally present. Now, what is the Y chromosome? The male chromosome, or traditionally the way we think of it. Now, what scientists that are doing this, you know, now that we have the means to observe this, not now that this is starting to happen, but now that we are observing it, what we look at, some of the scientists say, well, what do we do? What's going on? We look to the mammals in the mammal kingdom to see what they're doing as well. We find a very similar thing going on, okay? Now, this is a list of references. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, something, 20, I don't know. You can look at it later if you want to, but here they are. All right. Some of the things they're finding, for example, in a lot of mice, rats, moles, those sorts of animals, the same ones we do lab tests on because they share such a similar genetic structure, this is what they're finding, is that some have already totally lost, or the way they say, evolved to Y-less, without Y, Y chromosome and the SRY. Here are a few examples. Okay, now what's mysterious is because for all of these that are listed here, the exogenotype is present except for the Elobius Tancrei, which have XX genotypes for both genders. So we have what looks like under a microscope a woman being actually both genders, XX expressing both male and female. Other examples, in some of these lemmings and other mice, we find fertile females with either XX or XY genotypes. Wow. This is a surprise to me. So what's going on here? All right. Also, here's a Muntiacus crinifrons, or the black muniacs, small Asian deer. They're so big that we can't do the same changes in the genetic structure that the smaller animals are doing, so their X and Y chromosomes evolve to a totally new system that still we're trying to learn about. Maybe Brad knows more about this than I do, but this is just basic what's going on. Some scientists want to add, in the evolutionary future, Homo sapiens, or humans, to that, all right? So, here we have, then, what we can't quite figure out, what maybe culture is trying to force these two runners to choose, make choices, go one way, when their bodies are different. Now, I'm going to add one more picture here. Ah, this guy, okay? Why did I put him up here? I don't know. He doesn't look like any of the two. This is me. This is a picture of me. I'm not a runner. I don't share the same physical look, I suppose, but I am what a lot of the church or culture and society or the world at large would call gay or homosexual. Now, as long as I thought about it in terms of only sexuality and in terms of what that means and why everybody has a different opinion about it, I could not figure out anything but my next way to try and kill myself. And this went on for a number of years. But I don't look at myself that same way. It doesn't offend me if people want to point and say, he's gay. I'm, okay, great. Call me what you will. Homosexual, or whatever. These words, though, are not how I describe myself. Okay? Now, we've looked at the likenesses. Now, we've yet to look at some of the writings. Shall we, briefly? Here, we've got some minutes. All right. This is especially for the Mormon because Moses and the Pearl of Great Price and the temple ceremonies and such have a lot of insight, perhaps. Let's read from them. Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. Moses 2:27. And I, God, created man in mine own image, in the image of mine only begotten, created I him. Male and female created I them. Now, I think in our filters of how, maybe obviously, I don't know, have you guys ever seen pictures like Castor Semenya and Santi painted in the Company of Christ? Someone quite androgynous that you can't tell man or woman just by looking? I've never seen one painted in the Company of Christ. Much like our three friends. Anyway, but if we keep looking, I think a lot of how I'm approached on this subject is just from the Western approach of only male or female. That little word, or, does a lot. I don't find it in the scriptures. I find male and female. This is what else I find. Moses 6:9, even more explicit, in the image of his own body. I don't find that written anywhere else. Of his own body. Sounds pretty explicit, especially in a system of scripture that doesn't waste a lot of words. In the image of his own body, male and female, created he them and blessed them and called their name Adam in the day when they were created and became living souls in the land upon the footstool of God. Now, we can read this a couple of ways, like we've been saying. In the image of his own body, created males over here and females over here. Okay. Linguistically and cross-linguistically, the pluralization doesn't quite make the same sense. Or we can read it this way, perhaps. In the image of his own body, male and female. Male and female. Male and female. Male and female. Created he them. And called their name Adam. Let's go on. Doctrine and Covenants 20:18. And that he created man, male and female, after his own image, and in his own likeness created he them. Mark 10:6. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Matthew 19:4. And he answered and said unto them, have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? Most importantly, perhaps Paul, when he was seeing in the future, maybe a time when there is neither Jew nor Greek, as many of you have been baptized into Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, covenant or heathen. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female.
for we are all one in Christ Jesus. Okay, last thing. I think my time's up anyway. I'm just about. Picture this. This time don't close your eyes. I'm going to turn on the lights for just a second and look around the room. Because I've had the best view, I get to see every one of you. Look around the room. Look at each other. Don't be ashamed. In America, we have a hard time looking at each other. In Italy, you know, in other places, I can go up and stare at Brad like this all I want. And when I'm done, you know. Look, I don't even have to say hi to Brad, right? Maybe one of those faces is dealing with a difficult divorce. Maybe one of those faces is dealing with recent loss of a suicide child. Maybe one of those faces is dealing with those issues themselves. Those faces you've just seen, that is the face of God. That is the portrait that the Creator has left us, to know who the Creator is. Thank you for joining. And thank you for letting me see your faces today. Anyway, all right. Go ahead. Great. Very good.
I'm not quite sure how to even follow that.
There you go. I don't know either.
I mean, honestly.
You can go first next time.
You know, Andy and I had never met before today, and he had forwarded to me his outline from this presentation, and that was really all I had to go on. And you took a left turn on me, and I was kind of preparing to present my response on the artistic vein. And yes, you've done that, but you've created a much larger, all-encompassing world for us to function in here. And so, you know, my original ideas were talking about the images. You know, you started out, I think you kind of gave two different talks here, and you drew it together in a nice, tidy little maid's purse at the end.
Thank you.
You know, you started out talking about the icons that we have, our images, particularly in the LDS culture. I mean, are we saturated in icons or not? When he was talking about icons, talking about Nephi, talking about different images, asking us to pull up images, how many of you weren't flipping through the Del Parson Jesus in your head? How many of you weren't going through the Freiberg pictures? Are we even able to pull our own images? Are we able even to pull unique images that have personal meaning to us because we are so saturated and inundated in every chapel we walk in? We find the same artwork, we find the same pictures. When I tell my kids to imagine Nephi, I know exactly what they're going to think of. I can see the ship, and I can see Lehi, and I can see the Liahona. And I mean, can we create our own unique iconography for ourselves that has deep meaning to us personally? Can we do that? Or do we have to flip through the slideshow in our heads that we have as members of the LDS Church? Is there a right answer or a wrong answer to that? Is it okay that our images are collective rather than uniquely individual? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Did you want to respond? I think both, to have both, just to make sure that awareness, to not be limited by that which we create, to not be limited by our own creations. Anyway, that's
what I think is what you came back around to.
We have to have them.
Well, they're also part of what makes us a collective community, too. If we were all isolated individual islands, where then comes the community? Where then comes the relatability to each other? So, yes, I agree with you. I think it's important that we do have both. But I did have to laugh when you told us to call up an image, and I know everybody in here was imagining the same thing I was, and it kind of made me laugh. And you know, I have my personal preferences for the images of Christ. The trajectory of the image and how it's changed, I think, is really interesting too. You know, I think that the images that the early saints would have had of these things are really different than the images that we have now as modern saints. Because we are so, you know, you touched on media a little bit, we are so inundated, our images are correlated, whereas I think the early saints probably had a much broader base from which to draw their images that they imagined. Yet, you know, very early in the formation of our faith, you know, we had images being replicated that we can still see today on our temples, you know, on the sunstone balloon Moroni out there. You know, we do have these things. I think one of the important things you touched on was the transformation of the symbol. You know, we are awash in symbolism in everything we do. None of us are isolated from that. None of us function outside of that. And, you know, talking about the cross, you know, the boilerplate is why we reject the cross as Mormons. We all know that. Our kids know that. You know, why we don't wear the cross, why we don't decorate our buildings with it. You know, but like you said, it does have deep, deep meaning worldwide for just about anyone who, whether you claim Christ or not, it is the simple intersection of the two lines. But, you know, you likened it to an electric chair. I think that coming back around to how you wrapped it up is really important, that when you started going into the genetics and the transformation of the face of God and bringing it back to us, that's where you got me, because that's what I believe. Each of us is a reflection of the face of God. Each of us. And that the transformation of the image, you know, we are evolving as a population still. We may not be evolving as individuals, but as populations we continue to evolve, whether we're talking about, you know, the snakes or us. And that the transformation of the image of God is just like the transformation of the cross from being an instrument of torture to being an instrument of the salvation of the world. And I think that same thing is happening to our own images. So,
excellent. So I have about 8 minutes remaining. Open for questions. You can direct them at either Tracy or Courtney at any time.
I did picture the laughing Christ. Are you familiar with that
one? No, please tell me.
There's an image. I don't know. Are you connected to the internet? You could probably Google laughing Christ.
Laughing Christ. Well, let's see about it here. Am I? Who's?
I can pull it up, but
who's
I don't know
the
if
one?
I can get it up.
Guest.
Yes, guest.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Good. And then laughing Christ, you say?
Yeah.
I've never. My family has one, the one I forget, is it Adele Parsons who's over with his staff and the big lake behind him? We call it Duck Hunting Christ because it looks like he's got a big rifle. You know, he's getting ready.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
There was one
image here it is.
That they flashed up in General Conference a couple years ago that I swear it looked like Chuck Norris Jesus.
Oh,
I've seen that.
Have you heard me? There's a Liz Lemon Swindle that looks like Blue Steel Jesus.
Oh, is this the one?
Yeah.
Oh, I've never seen this.
He's
wearing
dreadlocks,
too. That's what I was going to say.
Lovely. I just love the diversity in how I would have never... Of course he laughs. I hope if he laughs. I don't know if I want to hang out too much if he doesn't ever laugh, you know. Good. Good. Thank you.
Question. I'm not sure if either of you would be able to answer this. I wondered why, with so much of the church art that's been correlated, why it doesn't actually follow either the way that people would actually look based on their bloodlines,
right,
or the way it's actually described. Because I remember reading an account of the first vision where it was describing Jesus and Heavenly Father as having bright white hair, and I've never seen an LDS picture showing them actually looking like Joseph Smith described them as looking. And I've never seen any pictures of Jesus or, you know, Nephi or Lehi that actually has them looking like they came from, you know, the Middle East and were therefore, you know, Israeli descent. And I was wondering, you know, first of all, I'm not sure if anyone would actually even accept those as realistic, but I was wondering, do you know why they don't actually try to show them in a more realistic or even as they're described manner?
The Italians cannot make a lot of their true recipes over here. Nobody will buy it. They'll eat it and they'll say, that's not Italian. Okay, I've made food like this. You know, I mean, same thing. You have to, you know, as an artist, I'm not sure that we can explore together. I don't have an answer. Joseph Smith, first words he says, I love, whose glory and beauty defy all description. Defy all description. So right there, start of it. Shut the book, don't read the rest of what he says, because it's a contradiction to what he just said. Defies all description. Now I'm going to describe. I don't think that works that way. You know?
What I keep hoping they'll do, and this is just my personal you know, I have the gospel art picture kit for my kids, and there's, you know, some pretty bad art in there.
Yes.
And there are, I believe there is a picture of the Savior and Heavenly Father with white hair somewhere in there. It's kind of a bad pencil drawing, I think. What I keep hoping is we just resort back to the pillar of light. I would like to see just a glow, leaving it for us to find a reflection that is meaningful to us. Because really, I think that's what it's all about. Everything that we can learn about the Lord and everything, these are all reflections, and we hold up mirrors for each other so that we can all figure out who we are. And I would actually like to see that, honestly, in the Temple movie as well, to see a pillar of light instead of a poor representation of something that couldn't possibly capture what I would imagine.
An omnipotent God, completely unbound, I suppose, would not be bound to the ways he could manifest in a burning bush to one, Moses, in person to another. The interesting thing I find is Joseph Smith even gave, what was it, 9 separate accounts of that first vision over his lifetime? And some of them, he's trying to remember exactly what he saw. He's like, I don't know how many I saw, you know, whatever. Yes?
I was going to say, one of my favorite expressions of account of the Buddha is when the expression is, if you meet the Buddha in the road, kill him. Mm-hmm. And I always used to sit in priesthood lessons and listen to the brethren give very definitive definitions of who and what God was and how he looked. And I'd already started reading Buddhist literature at that point and found myself feeling very uncomfortable that as human beings we could think we could so easily define who and what God was, male or female, or what the physical characters of these six were. So when I found that, I really loved that saying, just because it just showed us how we can't, as human beings, really do that.
Indeed. Do you like wearing the same thing every day? No, especially women in shoes, right? It's different shoes all the time. Please.
Well, I'm just thinking that I think that's a really important idea in art and in the temple film and whatever, just as I work a lot, doing things with the International Church, and I'm always really sensitive to that. You know, how do people in Cambodia feel about white Jesus and white
church in a white shirt and a tie?
My roommate came back yesterday from 2 weeks in Hawaii with her fiancé, and they went by the Polynesian Cultural Center, and the first thing she said to me, she comes into the house, haven't seen her in 2 weeks, we had a flood under our kitchen and everything, the first thing she says is, we went to the Polynesian Cultural Center and I couldn't figure out why there's a white Jesus and kids there and all these people are Polynesian. She said, so exactly like you're saying, I don't know what they were thinking. Go on. Thank you.
The Parson family has strong associations with Rexburg, Idaho, which is
That's
where
right.
I live. And our neighbor is an artist. He's an art instructor at BYU, Idaho. He told us that whole idea that somehow, I think it was maybe President Kimball, so one of the presidents looked at his depiction after Del Parson was commissioned to do what we in my family called that single portrait of Jesus in the red robe. We in my family, we called that Jesus when he played football for BYU. that image, that the prophet looked at that image and said, yes, that's it. That's a total Mormon.
It is
legend.
A Mormon urban legend.
But I was going to say, in answer to your question, there's a marvelous artist named Barry Moser who does a really amazing portraiture of Jesus as an ethnic.
Tell
identity.
Me again one more.
Barry Moser.
Barry Moser. I'm
yeah, Barry Moser. Uh-huh. Anyway, he's a New York artist, I believe. I wanted to ask you, though, it used to be that the illiterate masses, before most people could read, they would interpret meaning from the authorities and from their ecclesiastical leaders through imagery and symbols and art, etc. And it seems like we're almost coming, not quite, but it seems like we're coming full circle again, where we went through a period where most of our information was disseminated to us through the written word, the spoken word, now we are such an image-rich society, and so many of these interpretations, just like BYU football Jesus, he is probably the Jesus that most people associate with the real Jesus within the church. And I'm wondering if you, both of you, if you think we need a new literacy for how we interpret icons and symbols and these images that we are creating that stand up as this is what the church is and this is what we believe.
So that was probably our last question.
Do you want to jump on that? Or
go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think it's something that can be directed, to be honest with you. I think this is something that happens collectively and individually, almost organically, and there's something to be said for the comfort that can be garnered from these images that we see repeated within our own community. Sure, the language needs to be broadened, absolutely, but it will just happen as we individually broaden our language. It can't be broadened in a correlated manner. It's kind of counterintuitive. It doesn't work that way. So I think it just happens. In the natural evolution, for lack of a better word, of the image.
Go ahead, please.
There was a presentation at the BYU Museum of Art about 6 months ago called The Face of Christ.
I did go. Thank you.
You'll recognize that none of the stereotypical images were in there, but that exhibit was highly moving. Particularly a young artist, I believe his last name's Richards. I mean, some of those depictions are so far beyond the stereotypical, common, manual depictions of Christ. They were serious art and extremely moving.
Cheers, thank you.
Including ethnic Christ.
Thank you. The 2-second response now to your question, if I could, then. I'm glad you shared that, because that was one direction I wanted to take this originally, as I thought, it seems like we're kind of stepping back almost into pre-literate days, at least my generation younger, as we want to see the picture, we don't want to read what the story says. That's why we did the little exercise. But I find the most compelling, you know, if Del Parsons would have taken that image to Moses and said, where does he look? Like, nothing like him. There's no bush anywhere in here, no fire, nothing, you know? My point is that our individual connection to our Creator, yours to your Creator, however that's going to develop and come across, that's nobody else's business. No one can tell you at all who your Creator is and who that person is to you. That is your Creator. And what face that shape takes in time, it's only for you to decide and find out. Nobody else. Like Joseph Smith, who got to know for himself. Every one of us can do the same. Nephi, Jacob, his young brother, they both said the same thing. Mormon, Moroni, those many others throughout, said, see, I believe that our Creator wants to know us each personally, for this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. That is life eternal. That's not for other people to tell you what that means, okay? And how you know your Creator. That's my belief. Anyway, thank you again for joining. God bless you. All of you. Thank you.